Good morning, Arizona. Come on around back and let's see who we've got outside the landscape and yard this morning. It's Rosie on the house, your Saturday morning tradition for 28 years. To join the conversation, it's 1-888-767-4348. That's 1-888-ROSIE for you. You can text your questions in during the broadcast to 411-923, and you can email pictures to info@rosieonthehouse.com. And it looks like we have Mr. John Eisenhower of Integrity Tree Service talking trees this morning.
Good morning, good morning. And I have the privilege of having a friend in studio with us this morning. This is Rick Kober. Rick is a certified arborist, a consultant to the landscape industry, and I consider it a privilege to call him my friend, too. Rick, glad to have you.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
We're going to be talking lots about trees today, a lot about nursery trees. Rick has worked in the nursery industry for years and years, and it's we also share once a month, Rick hosts an arborist lunch. So arborists from around the city at Rick's invitation get together at the Persian Gardens at 15th Avenue and Thomas and talk trees, and it's been fun.
We do have fun third Thursday. In fact, that's next Thursday. So
yeah,
looking forward to getting together. I frequently invite Juan Barba, who's our friend from Tucson, and one of these days we'll get Juan up to join us.
I know he has a hard time getting up here just for that one event, but one of these days we're going to catch him when he's in the area. Yeah, if you are an arborist, a practicing arborist, and would like to come talk trees with us, feel free to join us.
Anytime. Open invitation.
Third Thursday of the month.
Now, becoming a certified arborist is no small task. If I want to go join this, I mean, I've got about 4 years of homework and testing to do before I can become a certified arborist and be a candidate for an invitation, right?
Well, you wouldn't necessarily have to be a certified arborist to be a part of that luncheon. But, yeah, a certified arborist is a the test is pretty rough. You know, it has a pretty high fail rate, which is great. We like, you know, it's good to keep the bar high. So you got to work to get there. And then once you get that credential, it's really great. It feels good to be able to let people know you've had a certain basic level of education to be in this industry. And then, of course, you have to maintain your certification by getting a certain number of continuing education units every 3 years and re-up your certification.
Now, before we get to our December talking points, let's talk about the tree of the month. And that's one of the reasons you've brought Rick in. Y'all have an ash tree.
Yeah, the tree that's become very popular in the nursery industry in the last several years is called the Fan West Ash. Now, people are perhaps familiar with the Fan Tex Ash. The Fan West Ash tree is a cross between a Fan Tex Ash and a green ash tree. It seems to get a little larger leaf and has a slightly larger canopy height and spread. It's just become a really popular tree. And there are several varieties of ash trees that we use here in the Phoenix metropolitan area, but the Fan West is really gaining in popularity.
Well, what I like about it, too, is it's really adaptable to poor soil conditions, and it's actually really good for colder areas. If you live in a very cold area and would like a deciduous tree that would manage those cold temperatures, this is a great choice and really vigorous tree and good-looking tree, attractive. You know, we lost a big eucalyptus tree between my house and my neighbor's house right on the street between our driveways. And it was a big 60-foot tree, fell down in one of the recent storms. And we've been planning to put a new tree in. We were waiting for winter and just because we wanted to put a nice deciduous tree in there once our lawn got established. And I'm thinking this would be a good choice for that location because it's a more upright growth habit, which most ash trees are. They grow taller than they grow wide. And it's great for those applications where you want a nice vertical line in your landscape.
Yeah, many people would be familiar with the shamalash. The Fan West kind of looks like a shamalash. It's a big dark green leaf and seems to do better in more situations than the shamalash. Shamalash seem to enjoy being in a turf situation in the Phoenix area. Mm-hmm. And the Fan West could grow in a rock yard or in a yard that has turf.
Nice, kind of like your Texas live oaks, too, are pretty durable that way. You can do well in a rock or a lawn setting.
So you lost a eucalyptus tree, and you're considering this Fan West ash. So you go to a nursery to pick one out. How do you walk through and pick out a tree? You go onto a lot of these nurseries, and there's 100 of one variety of tree. Do you just go, is one as good as the other, or do I need to go look at all 100?
Well, you know what I want to do is turn this question over to Rick. But before I do, I wanted just to mention there's two aspects of tree selection. One is to select the right tree variety, the right species. Once you've narrowed that down and you've decided on the tree you want to purchase, then there's the selection of qualities of that tree. When you go down those rows of hundreds of trees, and I'd like to ask Rick, if you were going to pick out a tree, you've already decided you want to buy the Fan West ash, and you go to the nursery and there's a rows of trees there, what are you looking for in terms of qualities containerized tree? What are some things to look out for and some things to look for?
That's a good question. I would say for me that the two critical aspects of tree selection would be branch placement. You want branches that are equally spaced as they go up from the main stem of the tree. You don't want branches that are what we would say a narrow crotch. We don't want branches that come out of the same growing point. We want branches that are staggered. So one on the left, one on the right, that would go radially around the tree. And I would say the second most important thing is to try and inspect what we would call the root flare or the trunk flare, the part of the tree where the stem goes into the ground. You want to visibly be able to see a widening of that stem
where the trunk tissue becomes root tissue.
Correct. Unfortunately, you know, in our industry, we frequently have trees that have been planted too deep, where they would take a smaller tree and put it into a larger container, and then put it into a larger container again. And
each time adding a little additional soil over the top of that.
Correct. So one of the things we try to do is we try to train people in the nursery industry to make sure that trunk flare is at or above grade. And when we talk about planting trees, we tell people to make sure that they plant about 90% of the root ball in the soil. And it's okay for root tissue to grow slightly above the soil level or in the air. It's very bad for the trees to have that stem tissue be below the grade of the soil. So branch placement's the number one consideration, and then number two would be the trunk flare.
And what happens if you don't see the trunk flare?
Well, you can plant the tree, or you could take your hands and you can push the soil aside and look down in the container to try and find out where that trunk flare actually is located, how deep in the container that the tree is growing in, how deep below the surface of the soil is the trunk flare. So if you do purchase a tree that trunk flare is not necessarily visible above the soil line in the container, when you plant your tree, you can knock off the first few inches of soil in the container.
Is it okay if a consumer goes and digs a little bit around the base of the tree in the nursery?
At most nurseries, we would be glad to see the consumer do that.
Yeah, just a general interest. Well, if it's buried significantly deep where you dig down and you can't find it within 2 or 3 inches, better to move on to the next
tree
and see if you
Correct.
Can.
And that's something that you and I do when we do consulting arboriculture. Will frequently be called onto a site at a commercial landscape situation where the tree may have been planted way too deep. I was at a property in the northwest part of the valley where the trunk flare was 15 inches below the surface of the soil.
Right.
And in that case, this was a very large tree that had been planted with a crane. It's almost impossible to replant a tree in that situation.
Yeah, they're too large to move them up in the soil. So what we've done sometimes is we'll dig down until we find the root collar, excavate out to about a 2 or 3 foot radius around the tree, and then remove that soil. Now the soil, the level now of the root collar is going to be slightly lower in the soil than the surrounding grade. So then we'll sometimes terrace with some brick or some riprap or something around to prevent the soil from migrating back down into that basin that we've created. But it gives the tree a wonderful lease on life because it's pulled the soil away from the root tissue, from the trunk, And now that there's no susceptibility to fungal pathogens attacking that trunk tissue, which is the real risk of having that soil too high above the root collar, because that trunk tissue can't take the water.
No.
And it, once that cambium gets mushy and or the bark gets mushy, the cambium can get invaded by fungal pathogens and eventually a tree can die.
Yeah, the main pathogen there is a disease called Phytophthora, and which means plant destroyer. And so basically when plants get Phytophthora at that location, it's usually fatal for the tree.
Yeah, it's pretty tough for them to recover, let alone that extra soil over the root zone is capping the oxygen to the root zone as well. So trees languish sometimes. They'll sit in the soil, you know, for a couple of years, and we'll see these customers will say, why is my tree not doing anything? It's healthy. It doesn't have Phytophthora, but it's not doing really well. And we find out that the tree's 3 or 4 or 5 inches too deep in the soil, and the roots are just struggling to get the oxygen they need.
Exactly.
And sometimes we'll excavate out, you know, 2 or 3 feet. We'll dig down and find the root collar, then excavate out. It might be 2 or 3 inches of soil even. And with our high, tight clay soils, you know, it's like an oxygen cap. We'll pull that soil out, create a little basin, and, man, those trees have just responded beautifully, and they've flourished.
1-888-767-4348. That's 1-888. Rosie, for you, when we get back, we'll get to December's checklist on our Talking Trees calendar and your calls. 1-888-767-4348.
We're in the yard with certified arborist John Eisenhower of Integrity Tree Service. Call with your questions right now at 1-888-ROSIE-4U.
Hey, weather's great. We've got some rain recently. I don't have to do anything to do my yard, right, John? I can just forget about it and kick back and take a break.
Man, this is a beautiful day to get outside and do a little bit of gardening, a little bit of putzing around. You know, this is a great time of year. One of our December Talking Tree points is it's a great time to do composting. You know, your fall deciduous trees are dropping a lot of leaves right now. A great time to be raking those up. Instead of putting them in a bag and dumping them in the trash, get them into a pile. Even if you don't create a actual compost bin, which are easy to construct out of chicken wire or even some old pallets, put them in a pile. Just put them up in a remote corner of your yard somewhere, and as they say, compost happens. You know, just let those let that degrading take place, and add some green, add some brown. You know, the combination of the carbon and the nitrogen, and add a little bit of water. Get that compost pile cooking, and you know, by spring you'll have a great compost, a nice organic material you can work back into your flower beds and into those other areas of your yard where you want a little more fertility.
And with that compost, I don't need it just for the garden. As you were mentioned, you can use it in lots of areas of the yard, including your trees.
Sure. In and around your trees, in your gardens. Yeah, it's a great top dressing. You can actually plant into it. You know, I want to just be sure I don't forget to mention that gunk that you pull out of your gutters is awfully great stuff because it's already composted. A lot of times, if you haven't been up there in 6 months, that sludge that's in there this time of year, I love to pull
treasure.
That stuff out. Oh, it is. I tell you, that's a great add to your compost pile.
we still compost even though we don't have a garden. It's just something so satisfying about using things instead of throwing them away. So if you need some compost, let me know.
Well, Rick had you.
Well, I had an interesting comment. I just recently read a book about a mad scientist of the 30s and 40s and 50s. His name was Victor Schauberger. And Victor Schauberger worked in Austria as a forestry person. And he had some profound ideas and insights about nature. And one of the thoughts he had was that you should not cook your compost. Dr. Schauberger, I guess he wasn't a doctor, but Victor Schauberger believed that making compost slowly and letting it decompose naturally and not letting the heat build up was actually better for the compost, the ultimate end product. So recently, I personally have been composting by not allowing my compost pile to heat up. And I think it does make better compost.
It's a little longer process. But
a little longer process. I tell people making good garden soil is like making good soup. The more ingredients you use and the longer time you take, the better the soup is.
So how do you keep it from getting
great
hot?
Advice.
Do you just not let it pile up too deep?
Correct. And when John was talking about mixing a certain amount of the green and a certain amount of the brown, the more green waste that you add and the bigger your pile, the more likely the compost is to heat up. So I try not to use too much green, and I always add a little more dirt, native soil, into my compost, and I keep the pile small.
Yeah, and if you have to have a certain depth of composting materials to build up the heat. You need about 160 degrees to actually start that cooking process. The longer-term process, you're looking at a year or so for composting to take place naturally without the heating process. If you do try to heat it up, it really accelerates that process, and in about 90 days you can have a finished compost product. But you have to turn it regularly, add water, and, of course, keep that blend of the green and the brown materials to get that compost happening.
And the key is the critters. One of the fascinating things in gardening is we used to argue 40 years ago when I was in the university, we'd argue about organic versus non-organic fertilizing. And what we've learned recently in the last 10 or 15 years that fertility, the fertilizing constituents, isn't as important as the diversity of the critters. So the more critters you have in your soil and the more diverse the population of organisms is, the healthier the soil is.
And critters like what?
Oh, actinomycetes, worms, arthropods, insects, bacteria, fungi. We actually now can analyze soils by the RNA strands. And the more RNA strands that are in the soil, we know the more diverse the critters are that are in the soil. So one of the things that agronomists are doing relative to diversity right now is analyzing a soil before and after, let's say, composting. And you can actually analyze the amount of RNA that's available in the soil after composting as before, and you can actually determine that you have more biological diversity afterwards.
And this whole composting process, too, is increasing that microbial activity in the soil. And when you're adding that back into sometimes our pretty inert soil, we don't have a lot of OM, organic material, in our soil to start with. So if we can take that leaf litter and put it back in one way or another, we're actually increasing and improving this soil microactivity, so the microbiological activity in our soils, encouraging some more of that diverse plant life.
Yeah, it's like making good soup. The more ingredients you have in the soup, the better the soup.
And it's a better environment for worms to get in, to be there, to be all those other microorganisms to be flourishing. It's the rhizosphere, the root zone itself, and to be able to make that a more favorable environment for all those critters you're talking about makes it a more favorable rooting environment.
Amen.
We appreciate the sermon. I never feel like we have a conversation with John Eisenhower. We're in a tree sermon. John Eisenhower, Certified Arborist of Integrity Tree Service, and your guest is?
This is Rick Kober. Yes.
Of Arid
Solutions.
Wholesale nursery. Retail nursery.
Yeah, yeah. Come by and see me anytime.
All right, we're going to get to the calls right after this. Matt's first in Phoenix wants to talk about his peach tree. 1-888-767-4348 to join the conversation.
Have a tree question and you're stumped? We're out in the yard with certified arborist John Eisenhower with Integrity Tree Service. Call with your questions right now at 1-888-ROSIE-4U.
Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with Rosie on the House. We're bringing Matt into the conversation to talk to certified arborist John Eisenhower, as long as horticulturist Rick Kober. It's a very Dutch name, as I understand and just learned, if it's not Dutch, it's not much.
That is correct. If it's not Dutch, it's not much.
Probably a combined plant, tree, horticultural knowledge between the two of them of, I guess it depends on how much you want me to age y'all, but it's probably more than my lifespan.
I think John and I are the same age. We go back to graduating from high school in the early 70s. So.
Matt, you're online. Welcome to the program.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I have a peach tree in my yard. I'm in the Gilbert area. And I planted a peach tree and an apple tree about 4 years ago. And the apple tree is doing perfect. It's growing tall. It's got a nice ball on the top and a nice, healthy trunk. The peach tree, on the other hand, is just growing tall, and skinny. It's probably 20 foot tall, and the trunk at the base, where it comes out of the ground, is only about 2 inches in diameter. So I got to have it propped up all over. What am I doing wrong, or what can I do to increase the size of the trunk and make the tree more stable?
Well, you know, has it borne any fruit yet, the peach tree? It does. And have you been cutting it back every year?
Yes, sir.
Well, as you, if it's still 20 feet tall and you've been cutting it back, that shows you how vigorous those peach trees can be. And you do need to keep them at a manageable height. I would recommend possibly cutting it back a little deeper than you have in the past, because it shouldn't be quite that tall. You want the fruit to be at a manageable harvesting height of maybe 12 feet max. And you can do that by just cutting back deeper into the wood, you know, maybe into some 1-inch diameter cuts. If it's only 2 inches diameter at the base, that seems like a pretty tall tree for that size trunk.
Yeah, I used to help Dr. Jim Downer, who's very active with the International Society of Arboriculture in Ventura County. They would have a course every spring on training people how to properly prune their fruit trees. And Dr. Downer used to say, when you prune your peach tree, you want to prune it halfway, and then you want to prune it again. So you could prune your 20-foot peach tree down at least to 8 feet, and this maybe January, and that would help encourage the tree to develop some more caliper lower as it goes into the ground. It will also enhance the fruit production this year.
And we do recommend pruning most of your deciduous fruit trees in the winter, December, January. And peach trees produce fruit on current year's growth. So whatever growth is produced on the wood that emerges in the spring is going to be the fruit-bearing wood. So keep that in mind, that, you know, you want to be you can pretty much determine the height at which your fruit is developed and can be harvested by how far down you cut it in January. So if you want that new growth that's going to emerge, 3 or 4 or 5 feet of new growth, and you've cut it down to the 8 feet that Rick just recommended, then you'll have all your fruit in that 8 to 12 foot range. And that's a really nice harvestable size you can reach off of a ladder. Some people actually, when you have planted a brand new fruit tree, will cut it down at 3 or 4 feet off the ground, because then it'll the branch structure will be a candelabra of really low branches. Then your harvesting will be at that kind of shoulder height to almost able to be harvested from the ground. And but yeah, you can pretty much determine that by how far you want to cut it back each year.
Mike, excuse me, Matt, we appreciate the call. Chop it. That's what I hear. Chop it, chop it.
Chop it, chop that tree.
If you don't have the heart to do it, just hand your neighbor the saw and say, here's my mark. Turn around and don't look. And let him go to town.
No. I'm not going to let that go. There is a little more science involved in this. In fact, I was a little cavalier in my quick comments just for the sake of time. But there's a little bit more involved. You want to be able to space your pruning cuts well so that the branches that emerge are evenly distributed radially around the tree and vertically. So there's a way of cutting back your main scaffold branches when you're trimming deciduous fruit trees. Don't just cut it back to the trunk. You want to, you know, leave some of those main scaffold branches, but cut all of them back evenly. And if you need any further instructions, there's some great online resources for trimming fruit trees. By the way, the U of A, Maricopa County University of Arizona Agricultural Extension Office, has some wonderful, wonderful publications. I was on their website this morning. And in regard to selecting trees, with regard to which we talked about earlier in the broadcast, as well as pruning deciduous fruit trees, go to the U of A website. In fact, if you go to our website at itreeservice.com, the very first article is Arboricultural Resources, and there you can find the U of A website and just click on the link. So go to itreeservice.com, go to our articles page, and you can look at the Arboricultural Resources, and you'll find that U of A publications website, and just click on that. And it's got a wealth of great information.
Mike is next on the line, and Chandler wants to talk about one of our John's favorite topics, killing sisu roots. Mike, go ahead.
Yes. I had a couple sisu trees that were probably about 30 feet tall, and the roots started, of course, going crazy, like I guess they're used to doing. So I chopped them down, stump ground them, drilled them, poisoned them with a stump ground stump killer. I put bags of charcoal on them and lit them on fire. I put diesel fuel, gasoline, motor oil.
You're missing arsenic. You know, haven't heard salt.
I had 40 trees growing up in my grass.
Yeah, we won't say where you live, so EPA doesn't come knocking on your door. I want to ask you, you did grind out the stump. Did you treat the stump with your contact herbicide before grinding it, or was that all things you did afterwards?
I believe I stump ground it first, then drilled it, drilled the holes and put the stump killer in it.
Right. Well, our recommended process is to cut the tree down and then actually drill the stump and treat the and put the contact herbicide into the drilled holes in the stump prior to grinding it out. Then we wait about 30 to 45 days to let the systemic herbicide, you know, get out into as many of the roots as possible. And then we come in and grind out the stump. If you do it the other way, which we've has happened in the past, it's pretty difficult because you've destroyed the mothership, and all the satellites are still active, and it's really tough to now track down all those roots because those roots now you don't have any way of delivering the contact herbicide to those outlying roots. What we found is when you do treat a stump, we get about a kill to about 10 or 12 feet from the stump. Everything dies. Any root activity beyond that 10 or 12 feet still will survive, and you have to then start spot spraying and treating the sprouts that emerge. It's a bit of a long process, but it can be done. You just have to continue to be vigilant, to find out where all those sprouts are and dig down and paint them, treat them. Expose what we sometimes have done is expose as much of the root surface as we can in those outlying areas and then treat them with a contact herbicide by either spraying or painting it on.
Don is next on the line and brings us our next December talking point organically as we address frost protection. Good morning, Donna from Tucson.
Good morning. I have a small question. About 20 years ago, my darling planted, well, lots of plants, but these two, I thought they were trees, but they're not trees, they're bushes, and one is lemon and one is lime. They've never bared fruit, and usually every year I cover them. So this year I thought the pomegranates we don't cover anything else. Do I have to cover those bushes, and should I trim them now?
This is your citrus, your lime and your lemon? Yeah, you have a much colder climate there, you know, five degrees cooler than it is in Phoenix. So you need to be thinking about definitely covering your small citrus. Your deciduous trees and shrubs like your pomegranate are perfectly fine without covering those. They lose their leaves and are very frost tolerant. The citrus, though, you're going to need to take some measures to cover those and make sure that they're protected. There's some good quality commercial products out there available at most good nurseries will provide some frost cloth. And you want to be sure that when you put the canopy of frost cloth over your plants that you extend them all the way down, let them drape all the way to the ground, and then seal them. Don't tie them off around the trunk of the tree because it's the soil moisture and humidity that's trapped underneath the canopy of the frost cloth that does most of the frost protection. So make sure that the canopy of your frost cloth goes all the way down and creates a dome around the tree.
Yeah, I'd like to add one of the interesting things about using frost cloth is that it actually works better. People will ask the question, can I leave it on? And one of the difficult things about leaving it on is, like John alluded to, the radiant heat, the energy that's hits the ground and hits the tissue of the plant during the daylight sun period gets trapped under the frost cloth during the night and radiates back up. So you actually get a better protection using frost cloth when you remove it the following day. But realize it's really a critical temperature difference between 27 and maybe 31 degrees Once you get lower than 26, 27 degrees, it's not really going to matter whether you leave it on or take it off if we have a prolonged series of days with temperatures below that 26, 27 degrees. But on the days when we're dipping down to 31, 32 degrees, frost cloth works much better when you remove the cloth in the following day.
Right, and if you've got larger plants that are require quite a bit of work to get them installed, of course it's practical to be taking them off every day, every night.
Christmas lights.
Some of our customers, or we just installed some large covers over some very large ficus trees that are 12, 15 feet tall, and we do those once a year and leave them on all winter, and the trees just do really well. We have some lights up inside there that. To add some additional heat to the inside canopy. And at night, they're like big, huge Christmas ornaments.
They look beautiful.
They look beautiful from the outside.
On the topic of citrus, let's bring Bill from Buckeye into the conversation, and he wants to talk about when to prune them. Welcome to the program, Bill.
Hi. We have a lemon tree that it produced quite a bit last year, but my problem is I've got some shoots, about five or six of them coming out of the center of a tree that grows up 5 or 6 feet higher than the rest of the tree. And I wanted to know if I could top those off, how I can stop those shoots from growing up like that.
We will pick up on that conversation right after the break. We can do a lot of things here at Rosie on the House, but we can't stop the clock. 1-888-767-4348. That's 1-888-ROSIE for you to join the conversation with Mr. John Eisenhower of Integrity Tree Service and Rick Kober of Arid Solutions.
Call now to get your tree questions answered by ISA certified arborist John Eisenhower of Integrity Tree Service.
Going into the break, Bill was on the line and he's got some shoots coming out of a lemon tree. Chop or do not chop?
Chop.
Chop.
Yeah.
Chop.
Those suckers that come up, whether they're below the root graft or even emerging from higher areas in the tree, they generally are upright and vigorous, often thorny, and more thorny than normal. And they'll grow right up through the center of the tree, and they're looking for sunlight. They'll often go right past the rest of the canopy and be sprouting way above the top. Rather than cutting them at the regular crown of the tree, we recommend taking those all the way back to the point of attachment and just cutting them. If they sprouted, though, due to the fact that the tree was over-trimmed in the past, they might be filling some voids inside the tree and actually providing some critical shade protection to the inside. So just be careful. If you think it might have been a response to over-pruning, then maybe it would be good to just kind of keep them under control and allow them to stay inside the canopy. The other thing is I wouldn't do any of this pruning until spring. Don't do it now. It's the trees need their winter coat, and just a couple of additional months of leaving those in the tree is not going to harm the tree, but I would wait until after mid-February to be taking those out.
Other bullet points on our Talking Trees December checklist?
Well, we've got a couple of – I wanted to just, again, remind everybody now's a great time to be thinking about your tree selection for spring planting. We have it's a great time to do that research. There's lots of great resources. Go to our website and also to the U of A publications for just like getting ideas on what trees to be planting. Speaking of planting, Rick and I were talking before the broadcast just about plant activity in the winter. And there's a real interesting phenomenon that root activity, even though our top growth is slowing down, the root activity continues in the soil. And Rick, talk a little bit about that from a horticultural standpoint. What's going on in the soil during the winter months?
Yeah, what happens, plants know, particularly deciduous plants, but even plants like Palo Verde trees or Sisu trees or trees that are green year-round citrus trees, all trees know that they need to store carbohydrate for the flush of growth that occurs in the spring. So what plants do is they produce carbohydrates through photosynthesis, and then they store those carbohydrates in their stems, their trunks, and in their roots. So it's amazing how I noticed this year at the nursery, the caliper of trees actually increases dramatically from September through November. So when I look at the girth of the trees in May, June, July, August, they're pretty much the same, and most of the growth in the tree is in the branches and in the leaves. But starting in the fall, when the nights begin to get longer, the trees begin to start laying carbohydrate down into their stems and into their roots. So they get fatter caliper going into October, November, December, because they're storing carbohydrates so that when the spring flush of growth occurs, they have a storage of carbohydrates. A deciduous plant doesn't have any leaves on it for that flush of growth when the weather changes in February, March. So they have to use the reserved carbohydrates that they've stored in their roots and their stem to really push start the tree, kickstart the tree when that flush of growth occurs.
Which is a reason why we recommended that fall fertilization, because that root activity is continuing throughout the fall and winter months, even though the top growth is slowed down. It's interesting, too, how sometimes after our kind of summer dormancy that we have with many of our trees, that they have a resurgence in the fall.
Amazing.
Interesting how all of a sudden your roses have a second kind of renaissance. And Roman, weren't you saying you had some trees in your yard, too, that were pushing out some fall growth, you know, later in the year?
Our citrus having a huge growth push. You had mentioned ash trees. We have 7 ash trees. They all had a new huge growth push. Our mulberry trees, this was such a long, mild fall. It was almost like they thought it was spring coming into summer again.
Again, back to Rick's point, is the trees are getting ready for this, you know, quieter time in the winter, storing those carbohydrates for the spring push of growth. So lots going on underground that we may not see above ground, starting in the this next couple of months, December and January. Interesting that there's caliper development of our trunk tissue, and the roots are still colonizing more soil underground and ready for that big spring push coming up.
Rick, y'all are a wholesale and retail nursery, which is unusual in the nursery industry.
We are open for retail. We are a wholesale nursery, and we do get a lot of retail customers. There are a few nurseries in town that are like that. There is a dichotomy for the most part in Arizona where some nurseries are exclusively wholesale and generally just grow plants for other nurseries and for the landscape trade. But yeah, we're one of the few that are both retail and wholesale.
Where would I find Arid Solutions?
Arid Solutions is at 3815 East Southern. So we're on Southern Avenue just west of 40th Street in Phoenix.
Mr. Eisenhower, Integrity Tree Service. Somebody would locate you during the week at?
Best place is go right to our website at itreeservice.com, the letter I, treeservice.com. Find all of our contact information. There's a contact page there, too. If you have any questions, you can always just drop us an email. And lots of good articles there for to keep you busy this weekend.
Dave, Kristen, Tina, all with Tree Questions Online. Don't hang up. We'll answer your questions off air during the news break. 9 o'clock hour coming up. If it's the open line hour, anything you want to talk about, your house, home, castle, or cabin, get online now at 1-888-767-4348.